ADT be down from any one carrier and meet the FCC requirements by the method by which confirmation takes place. It's something like a standard averaging meter, if you know what I mean. So I do recommend a proof of concept measurement on at least one. And I'd love to hear more about this, guys, as you guys do the final refinement of this product into Mike Hotel, K2LIW and the Tech Man.
Okay, K2RIW, N2MH. Well, as a matter of fact, standard procedure on tuning up the head end and coming up with the aggregate is to use a spectrum analyzer and make sure all the carriers are with, say, like a dB or so of each other. It's kind of impossible to get them all exactly on the money, but, you know, you take a working approach to do it and get them all within a dB or so. And that is the composite signal going into this amplifier. And for what it's worth, this amplifier, this whole system was first devised in Bohemia on Long Island, I believe it was, in the 1980s. Anyhow, I'm going to go back to listening mode here. I have to get to bed because I get to work tomorrow. And it's going to be an early departure from home here. Nice meeting you, Dick, and keep up the net here. K2RIW, this is N2MH.
Very fine, Mark. Nice meeting you. And, yes, in Bohemia, I guess it was, at one time, they made some pretty good products, and I know what you're talking about. And good luck with that project. Next person on our list was Joe number 2, KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe. K2LIW and the Tech Man.
Yeah, hi, Dick. Name is Joe number 2, KC2QYW. Yeah, Dick, my question is, can I use a digital inverter, I guess they're called power digital inverter, to run a refrigerator instead of using a generator? I guess they run from like 200 watts all the way up to probably like 3,000 watts. My question is, can I use a digital inverter to power a refrigerator? Back to you, Dick.
I think the answer is yes, Joe number 2. However, let me backtrack for Mark. And that is, he's got to go to bed, and if he wants to listen to the rest of the TechNet, as long as he's willing to wait half a week or so, there's a website where all of these TechNets get recorded, and you can download those audio recordings into whatever kind of a recording device you've got, your iPod, iPad, you know what I mean. And then some people, like Joe's got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get through his job on time, so he's got quite a bit of commuting time, and he could be playing back those particular audio recordings at that time if he wanted to, if he thinks there's enough value there. And that website is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there, in the last 6.5 or 7 years of the TechNet, 99% of it is all recorded. Some of it is documented, and you can play it back. And to some people, there's quite a bit of information there. Now, when it comes to the inverter, a circuit that takes 12 volts to 24 volts out of batteries, converts that into a quasi sine wave to run a piece of machinery. Let me drop. There's a yes and a no to that one. In the old days, the inverters put out a pure square wave, and a hell of a lot of machinery and things like television sets were looking for the sine wave peak, 120-volt sine wave that's got 167-volt peak, and the power supply rectifies that peak and then filters it. And you put in a 120-volt square wave, the peak voltage there is only 120, the power supply would be starving. So in a case like that, the old-fashioned pure square wave inverter didn't really hack it in a lot of cases. The newer inverters are what I call the stepped square wave. They got it's sort of a staircase-like circuit, digitally operated. And it does hit the 167-volt peak, and the steps sort of kind of follow a sine wave. However, a refrigerator, when it starts up, is a heavy inductive load. These inverters work beautifully on resistive loads, things like incandescent light bulbs, whatever. and maybe a room heater, things that are running in a resistive manner, because the motor is such a heavily inductive load, and inverters in general don't like an inductive load, you need a huge overrating. In other words, if your particular refrigerator needs 250 watts of lock rotor starting volt amperes, if it needs 250 watts of volt amperes to start, and if you had an inverter, a stepped up inverter that is only rated for 250 or 300 watts, there's a high probability it wouldn't hack it. So you're going to have, in my opinion, a significant overload capability. In other words, if your refrigerator is rated for 250 watts, maybe you better buy a 1,000-watt inverter to make sure it can do it, to be able to pick up a heavy inductive load. And in some cases, what some people have done is to put a 100-watt light bulb on there on the load before they start up the refrigerator.
Repeater, timeout, cancel. Put
a 100-watt incandescent light bulb on there as a resistive load before plugging in the refrigerator, so that now the inverter can see at least a partially resistive load, not a pure inductive load. I know the answer is you can do it, as I see it. Remember that one easily, joke number two. I know you can do it, but you've got to be a little bit careful in the selection and the amount of overrating, knowing that these inverters, in some cases, become extremely unhappy when they see a pure inductive load. And black rotor, that motor that's part of the compressor of that refrigerator, is a heavily inductive load when it starts up. And in some cases, an inverter with that particular environment either doesn't start at all, the inverter doesn't run, or it runs in a crazy mode, if you know what I mean. So I know you can do it, you've got to be a little bit careful. Now you know a little bit about where the minefield is in this particular situation. KC2QYW, KQYW in the TechNet, N2LDY recognized. We'll get to you in a second. QYW first, go right ahead.
Yeah, Roger, Dick. I do have one, and it's rated for 800 watts. I will be using it for my lights and my fan and my ham radio equipment and whatnot. But I think it's too low to work the refrigerator. So I guess it's safe to probably get like maybe a 3,000 watt or a 5,000 watt portable digital inverter to be on the same side. And I'm using one of those Optima gel batteries, and they work very beautiful with the inverter. And that's it. One last question. Do you know like how many watts a refrigerator is? We have like a medium-sized refrigerator. I'm not sure how many watts it is. It might say it on the paperwork in the back of the refrigerator, but maybe you might know on top of your head.
There I don't know, Joe. And there's a huge difference in the efficiency factor of various refrigerators. Some of them have an efficiency factor that's extremely high, and some of them do not. And even if they did give you a wattage rating, that would be the average running wattage rating, not the starting wattage. At the instant you first turn on that compressor, the total amount of volt amperes it draws could easily be 5, maybe even 10 times higher than the average rating once it's running. So you got to be a little bit careful with that. So you'll have to go to the manufacturer to get that number, to use some kind of an estimation factor. We'll have to run a couple of tests to make sure it really can start up reliably, and not just sit there and hum with locked rotor because the inverter is putting out some kind of a crazy waveform at that time. When you do solve this problem, because it's a fairly universal problem in my opinion, Joe, number two, please come back and let us know what you find out as to what works and what doesn't work. N2LDY, I wonder if you got some comments on this one, Don. K2LAW and TechNet, you got it, Don.
I was going to throw something in here. I actually have a 2,500-watt inverter set up. It's mounted in the garage, and I backfeed the both phases back into the house. So I turn off all the 220 items. you know, anything that's been directly pointing, you know, like the stove, the dryer. And I vacuumed the house, and it's perfectly happy running the entire house, including the refrigerator. What I use is like a couple of, you know, heavy duty batteries, and I have a 12 volt generator that I made up out of an alternator with permanent magnets in it. So it's like a wind generator type of alternator, so it has permanent magnets. And so at a high idle, that thing is happy, putting out like 50 amps into my batteries. And when I run the house over the 2000 amp and I watch generator. So that's how I ran 5 days the last time. Let me just empty a second. When we had the last hurricane and we lost power, and I just ended up going through a couple of fan belts, but other than that, it was pretty good. It worked out good for me.
And you live in the Center Region. I don't know how long you were out during Hurricane Irene. I was out for a day and a half, as I remember, on my particular. As I drove around my town at the night of Hurricane Irene, two-thirds of the town was completely black. One-third of the town had continuous power. One town of my little community of Dix Hills, part of Huntington. And every so often I would see a house that lit up like Luna Park in the middle of a blacked-out area. I was wondering, what in the world is going on? As I drove by slowly and opened up the window of the car, I could hear a generator running in the backyard. So I knew what was happening. So one of the things that happened, I'll give you a little bit more of a hint. Maybe somebody wants to know about this one. Let me drop it. A good friend of mine went and bought a 240-volt inverter, alternator, that starts off with battery power, and I think it was rated for 10,000 watts or some number like that. His actual load were 110-volt circuits, and on the A phase, I'm going to call it, he probably had 100 watts of load, and on the B phase, he had 200 watts of load, numbers like that, on something that's good for many thousands of watts as an inverter, and it's a 240-volt inverter. It failed continuously, time and time again. They thought they had a bad one, they went and bought another one. The problem was that a 240-volt inverter wants to be a thoroughly balanced 240 volts. When you've got 100 watts of load on one side, 200 watts on the load on the other side, you have a significant amount of common mode current flowing through the so-called ground wire, the third wire of that system. And for reasons I don't thoroughly understand, the typical design of very well rated, very good brand name alternators really didn't like that, and they would fail. What they finally had to do to make the system work correctly is to run two separate inverters. One inverter fed the A phase, one inverter fed the B phase, and now as long as each one of those inverters had high enough power to handle that amount of wattage, no problem. So the so-called 240-volt inverters, on paper they look great. In the case of a rotary machine, I own a rotary machine motor generator set, which is rated at 240 volts of output. I backfeed my house with that, and it works like a charm, even though my red wire phase and my black wire phase, color phase A and color phase B of my house, are never balanced. In the case of a rotary machine, they can take it. But in the case of solid-state inverters, at least the very good brand names cannot take it, and therefore individual inverters at 120...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A pair of individual inverters at 120 volts output each is what you have to do in a case like that. Wonder if this is coming a little bit close to what you're discussing, Don. N2LDY, K2LIW in the tech map.
My inverter runs on 120. It's not a 20 inverter, it's a 110 inverter. And, I'm just, you know, I've had two sockets on there, and I wired one of them to the one phase and the other socket to the other phase, which I'm sure is common to one another. So I'm just, you know, running two phases with the same 110 inverter. And, you know, it's happening as long as, you know, as long as I don't turn on the speed warning, you know. And it worked fine. It worked fine, and we knew that power for days. So hopefully we won't have the same problem again. But, you know, it should work if we do.
I think you did what I did, as I see it, Don. When I only had a single extension cord that's good for 120 volts, I didn't have a 240 volt extension cord coming from my 240 volt motor generator set, which is rated for 4 kilowatts, which is as long as I don't turn on a whole lot of burners in the house, or the air conditioning system, that handles it very nicely. What I did do was to use a, first of all, I disconnected the main circuit breaker between me and the Long Island Power Authority. You don't want to try to pick up the whole darn block, if you know what I mean. That's the first step. The second step is I put in a pretty heavy jumper cable in between the red wire and the black wire. In other words, the phase A and phase B, I wired them in parallel, which is close to what I think you're discussing. And then I backfed the house with 120 volts. And the nice thing about doing that is now whether you draw more power on the A phase, the black wire phase, or the B phase, the red wire phase, in my example, doesn't matter. They're all in parallel. And if you make the mistake of turning on a 240 volt load, because you've got the A and B shorted together, the voltage across the 240 volt appliance will be 0 volts. Turning it on does nothing. But there's a catch. When you take a typical electric range and you go through all of the clicks of a low, medium, high, civil, and everything else, you'll discover that what it's doing is sometimes putting 120 volts in one of the coils and 240 volts on another coil and so on. It's got a whole bunch of individual steps. Those individual steps might work, but the higher power step, where it's putting 240 volts across all coils, it'll go down to zero. So it behaves in a slightly crazy way, as you can tell. But what you understand is that rewiring the house to put your two phases in parallel when you feed them 120, as long as you know what you're doing, as long as you've got insulated wiring and
repeater, timeout, cancel.
As long as you've got a good flashlight, insulated wiring, you're wearing rubber gloves, you have a standby person that is looking over your shoulder while you're doing this, I think it could be made safe. At least I've done it on multiple occasions and it works. Back to you for any other comments on this one then, Don. And 2LDY, K2LIW.
K2MMR.
No, I agree with you, absolutely. And so it's good to be safe. I actually will pick up the braking station. I just wanted to throw in, you know, that I do, and I have personally used the inverter and it works good. But, I mean, it's a fairly hefty inverter, though, you know. 2,500 watts, and I don't know what the surge is, but it's like probably close to 5,000 watt surge, you know. So, all right, I'm going to be listening, and I'll let you pick up the other station, and thanks for the net.
25, Don, thanks for stopping in. Ray, KC2, Mike Yankee, what do you got to say about all this? How do those smart guys in Yonkers solve this problem? You've got it there, Ray.
Hey, Dick, I was just wondering if you didn't have enough power to supply the surge for the refrigerator example on that high inductive start, would that damage the refrigerator? And the question applies both to inverters and, let's say, you've got quite a cheap generator like the one they always have at sale on the sale at the Harbor Freight. I got that one. I'm afraid of damaging the refrigerator if there's not enough power to handle that inductive start. Over.
I'm not completely sure on this one, Ray, when it comes to a refrigerator, but I can tell you what happens with the case of an air conditioner. My household central air conditioner, which I bought from Sears Roebuck a zillion years ago and installed it myself, what happens with it is that the worst-case situation is if Long Island Lighting Company gives me a one-second interrupt, and therefore the rotor, when it's been running, stops and tries to restart. During the 1 second of stop, whatever gas was being compressed in the cylinder at that time turns into a liquid. And then on the next cycle, when it turns back on, the compressor is attempting to compress the liquid that's in the cylinder, and you cannot compress the liquid. So it sits there, locked rotor, no matter what power you're putting into it. I'm now putting in full LIPA power, and then the 240 volts that I'm trying to apply to it, even with it drawing a ridiculous amount of current, it's getting 230 volts. It sits there and hums very loudly. And if you stay in that mode for very long, all kinds of damage can take place. Lucky for me, there is a thermal overload switch on the compressor motor itself. Let me drop. And if you wait for about 60 seconds, the motor gets hot enough that that thermal overload switch opens up. That's the good news. So it doesn't completely burn up. The bad news is that that thermal overload switch is opening at the time that it's drawing, let me pick a number, 10 amperes, some ridiculous amount of current. And after you're arcing and sparking those contacts with an inductive kickback of the heavy current loading at the instant they open, as such, that thermal overload switch is only good for a given number of cycles. Maybe it can tolerate that that environment with 25 or 30 cycles, after which it either is going to fail in the open mode and the motor will never run again, or it's going to fail in the welded closed mode, in which case the never next time it happens, you're going to burn up the compressor. As you probably know, if you ever talk to anybody that's in the air conditioning repair business, there's a significant number of compressors, compressors and condenser coil assemblies outdoors of a house of a central air conditioning that has to be replaced per year. It is my belief that a high percentage of those failures is the mode that I'm now describing. As such, there's an extremely simple solution that a lot of times does not get applied. And that is, you go to the Granger catalog or any other good electrical supply house, they will supply you a time delay device which works off of the, it works off the 110 volt line or the 24 volts that is operating on your thermostat that is powering the air conditioner. And if LIPA gives you an interrupt of anything more than a few milliseconds, this device goes into a reset mode where it will not allow the relay to be pulled in on the compressor for the next 3 minutes or whatever time you set it. So for some 3 minutes or 5 minutes of delay, when LIPA gives you a 1 second interrupt, this thing will not allow the air conditioner to be turned on again, in which case, after 3 or 5 minutes, the liquid that's in the compressor cylinder re-evaporates, and now when it starts up, it's a nice, easy startup. So that simple device I'm describing, which is about a $20 item, can save you $2,000 or whatever the number is to replace your compressor, in many cases it's more dollars than that, cannot have that $20 safety device installed. It is extremely false economy, in my opinion. So could a refrigerator also go into a locked rotor mode because it saw an interrupt for a fraction of a second? I think the answer is yes. So if your refrigerator has that safety device I'm describing, I think your refrigerator will last a hell of a lot longer. The thing I worry about now is when it is a solid-state inverter looking at a pure inductive load, depending on the design of whether or not it is a dual-stage inverter, the kind that is self-excited or the kind that is a separate exciter within the inverter itself. The so-called self-excited type, instead of putting out a 60-cycle step square wave, when it sees a highly... Instead of putting out a 60-cycle stepped square wave, the self-excited type might try to put out a 500-cycle wave when it sees a highly inductive load. And is your refrigerator going to be damaged by 120 volts of continuous 500 cycles? I think the answer is maybe. So you've got to be a little bit careful on this one. So there's two dangers there, as you can see. Highly inductive load, the inverter behaving in a crazy manner, frequency-wise and waveform voltage-wise. And second of all, any expensive refrigerator or air conditioner, if it doesn't have the time delay device, this interrupt protector that I'm describing, I'm not sure of the exact word for it, but it's about a $20 item. In my opinion, it's very false economy not to have that installed. Back to you on this one, Ray. KC2, Mike Yankee in Yonkers. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Comment, WS2N.
WS2N, we'll pick you up in the second call. Go ahead, Ray.
Okay, K2RIW, K2MMY. Yeah, that explains a lot. Thanks, Dick. And you would think you could buy the generator and just plug the refrigerator into it, but obviously that's not the case. And it's kind of annoying that it's not a common knowledge thing. So, apparently, to me, you could really burn out your refrigerator if you're not careful and you don't have the right, or at least enough to cover that inductive kickstart and some other protective devices, which is exactly what I want to know. So thank you very much for letting the other station go ahead, K2MMY.
The possibility here, Mike, is that I'm being a little bit too negative and maybe pointing out problems that are a little bit not quite as bad. But I'm really trying to let you know where the minefield might be, and I'd rather you not walk around across that minefield without intelligence, if you know what I mean. Now you know what to look for. Let's see how Paul has solved this problem. Here is WS2N, K2LIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Two items there. One, I just bought a couple of window air conditioners last year. Pretty there. And replace the state circuit. You know, they can tell you, you know, turn it off and then turn it back on again. Don't expect it to start up.
The independent current and voltage, it is the worst case. That's the volt amperes. Your mic measure, let me pick a number, 10 amperes at 120 volts, and come to the conclusion that it's a 12,000 volt amperes going in. But maybe this great big air conditioner only draws 1,000 watts when it's really running, not the 12,000 volt amperes that you've measured. Because of power factor and or locked rotor condition. Also, what I thought you were about to tell me, Paul, is that with a clamp-on ammeter, a really smart electronic engineer can say, for a lot of my life of my machine, I'm willing to dedicate my clamp-on ammeter, maybe I go out and buy a cheap one, and take the two leads coming out of it, go into some kind of a protect circuit that detects the fact that 10 amperes was flowing for more than 2 seconds, was, you know, way beyond the startup time, and now it's detecting a locked rotor, and therefore it creates an interrupt. It turns off the current to the relay, the contactor that allows the compressor to run. So it wouldn't be too difficult to build a clamp-on ammeter protect circuit that looks for the locked rotor condition more than X number of amperes for more than 2 or 3 seconds, and therefore does protection. The right solution, and that would be a slightly better solution than the timing circuit. And by the way, I'm glad to hear that the better brands of air conditioners and or refrigerators have that timing circuit built in. I know that the ones that I was familiar with. I know that the ones that I was familiar with, I was purchasing them 20 or so years ago when I did my installation. The vast majority of them did not have the protect circuit. So the better brands are going to have it. But it's something to look for, because I can offer a lot of them. I mean, the average person, when he's buying a fairly expensive item like this, he does comparison shopping. And the disadvantage of comparison shopping is you buy the one that has the right ratings as far as BTUs and cooling capacity and cubic feet and all that, and then you compare it against the dollars, and you buy the one that's giving you what you think is the best cost effectiveness. But you could be, in that process, buying the one where the manufacturer has skimped on this $20 item in order to increase his profit. Therefore, you don't have that protect circuit. There's a number of cases in life where buying the lowest price of what looks like a good item could be a disadvantage. There's a lot of cases where my wife selects an item, and I re-look at all of the details, and I buy the next or the third more expensive one because I want reliability. It's not just I'm looking for the cost of ownership, if you know what I mean, as opposed to just buying the one that's got the least amount of price to it. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in. I think we're ready for the mailbag. Let me double check that I haven't skipped over anybody. K2LIW listening.
K2LIW with a comment on that last subject.
Okay, I heard 2KW. Okay, give me the full call letters, give me your name, sir, and go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW, TechNet, my name is Dick.
Hi, good evening. This is Alan in Bayside, November 2 Kilo Whiskey. You know, the the tough things about getting old is the things change. You know, the rules change. But 40 years ago, when you had to pick out an air conditioner, the protective circuit consisted of a little fine print that said, wait 3 minutes before restarting. If you were smart, you obeyed what it said. Mark, bought another air conditioner. But when you picked an air conditioner, instead of picking the most efficient one, you picked the least efficient one, or the least efficient one with a brand name that you recognize, because that would be the most reliable. And if you would choose that. Over.
Well, in the case of a central air conditioner, which is one of the heaviest loads that I own in my house, the only thing that's heavier is maybe the dryer or the electric range and oven, but I only use those intermittently. In the case of a hot summer day, that air conditioner is going to be cranking some number of hours per day. So therefore, the EER rating, the efficiency rating, could represent a significant number of dollars of difference of my electric bill, particularly in view of the fact that on Long Island, because of the Shoreham nuclear station and the recovery of that, we have the second most expensive electricity in the total United States. There's only one electric company, a private one, in Hawaii that's higher in price than us. And if you really look at your bill correctly, I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but we're probably paying something like 17 cents a kilowatt hour when there are people in the United States that are paying 3 and 4 cents a kilowatt hour. So, the EER rating is one of the things that's hard to ignore. Let me drop. So I'd be willing to buy an air conditioner. And by the way, for the instruction manual from the manufacturer telling the owner to wait 3 minutes after turn off before you're turning it back on. That's great if you, the owner, created the interrupt. But if that interrupt was created by Loco, and the Loco does create periodic interrupts of a fraction of a second, you'd be amazed how many times per day it does happen. And each time that happens while your air conditioner is running, you could run into a locked rotor condition that you didn't cause. Therefore, that $20 protection circuit, you better double check as to whether or not it's there. So I would rather buy the high EER rating machine, knowing that it's a good brand name, and if it doesn't have the protect circuit, I'm willing to add it. Now, when Loco creates that interrupt, I'm somewhat protected. I'm reasonably well protected. I've done that, and let me think now. 1978 is when I've installed my central air conditioner. 78, 88, 98. That's 34 years ago. And because of that protect circuit, I've had no failure of any kind in that machine for 34 solid years. And I bought a high EER rating machine that the Consumers Report didn't think it was the best one, but it was available to me from Sears Roebuck at the time. And so I bought it, and for the time being, I'm happy with that combination. See where I'm going in this one, Alan. And two, kilowatt whiskey, C2RIW in the tech test.
Yeah, I'm glad you had good luck with the unit, but I had a discount personal testimonials for evaluating individual units. Although I didn't know that the protection was available outboard, and I did stipulate it actually was a lot cheaper than most important, I don't think Central. I think Monroe. Anyway, have a good night, and I hope the storm turns out to be a big nothing. That's okay, W.
I thank you for checking in, Alan. You said an outboard unit. This little protection circuit is a black square, about 2.5 inches wide, about 1.5 inches high, and about 3/4 of an inch thick. It costs about $20, as I remember. Sold in the Granger catalog and a number of other electrical supply houses. And you open up the panel, that's held in with a couple of Parker screws and sheet metal screws, and you install this thing alongside of the contactor. Your thermostat is supplying something like 24 volts, as I remember, to the contactor. It sucks in this great big set of contacts that allows the 220 volts to 40 volts to be applied to the actual compressor motor. You install this little thing in series with that 24 volt circuit from the thermostat, and therefore I wouldn't call it an outboard unit. It's something you're adding inside of the compressor of the outboard of the air conditioner compressor condenser unit that's outside the house in my central air conditioner. I've got a 3-ton system, and I'm also willing to use a so-called underrated Elkin air conditioner. 3 tons for a 3-bedroom house with only moderately good insulation maybe is underrated. And back in the days when LIPA was allowing you to buy, if you would give them permission, they would install this radio-controlled switch onto your central air conditioner, such that when they had a brownout condition, up to either 20 minutes or 40 minutes per hour, you're giving them permission to issue the radio control command that turns off your particular air conditioner. And I elected to have them do that, and they gave me a very nice rebate check each year, a couple hundred dollars, as I remember, because I allowed them to install that switch. From my point of view, as long as you have an adequate-sized air conditioner, even though it's only running 20 minutes per hour during their brownout, that was more than enough. The main thing an air conditioner does is take the humidity out of the air in your house, lowers the humidity. That's the primary thing it does. Whether or not it brings the 100-degree air outside down to 70 degrees Fahrenheit is not the most important thing. 85-degree Fahrenheit air in the house would be perfectly comfortable if the humidity is low enough. So when you watch that central air conditioner pour continuous water out of your house, I like watching that output tube, and the water is pouring out of there like it's a faucet turned on slowly, and that's the water it's removing from the air in my house on a hot, humid day. And I made a clear plastic tubing so I could watch that water pour out, and I sit there and I feel very comfortable, if you know what I mean. So air conditioning is kind of fun. Maintaining your own air conditioners, installing you yourself, maintaining your own oil-fired furnace are not rocket science. There are people who are afraid to touch that. We ham radio operators who think nothing about opening up the case of our piece of electronics, as long as we've owned it for a couple of years, and doing troubleshooting and repairing, you'd be amazed how much we can do and how much money you can save. So those particular appliances in the house, I think with the right attitude, are very maintainable. Got to be a little bit careful. Yes, you could get yourself in trouble, but with proper safety procedures...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
With proper safety procedures, it's very nice to have that capability. And if my furnace ever fails at 2 o'clock in the morning on Christmas night, where you would never get a repair person, and the fact that I've got the spare parts and know how to troubleshoot and repair it, gives me a warm and fuzzy feeling. I've never really had to do that, but I know if it did occur, I've got spare nozzles, I've got spare high-voltage transformers, I don't have a spare blower motor, I don't have a spare oil pump, but those things are very rarely a failure item. So I can maintain my own furnace, if you know what I mean. Okay, we should go over to the mailbag now. John, KC2WGB, what kind of great letters have we gotten tonight? Drag your feet a little bit in case anyone else wants to give us any more reports about the weather. KC2WGB with a delay, KC2RIW in the tech net.
Log 10 dBs
for measuring power. So if someone told me I've got a 100-watt amplifier, and I'm about to, at a flea market, buy a 200-watt amplifier, an afterburner for my either my automobile or my base station, doesn't matter. And I want to know what's the difference between 200 watts versus 100 watts, because I'm starting off with wattage. It is 10 times log. So 200 divided by 100 would be a 2-to-1 ratio. The log of 2 is 0.3, multiplied by 10 would be 3 dB. So a 200-watt amplifier is 3 dB more power output than a 100-watt amplifier. Now, if I want to know the raw power going into that amplifier, I'm feeding 12 volts into it. And if I know that one amplifier draws 10 amperes, and the other amplifier draws 20 amperes, different amplifier. A different amplifier draws 20 amperes, and one of them draws 10 amperes. And I'm now talking about current or voltage independently, assuming now the current is the one that's changing and the voltage is constant. In that case, the 2-to-1 ratio of the example I gave, 20 amperes versus 10 amperes, I would take the log of 2 over, the ratio is 2 to 1, 10 divided by, 20 divided by 10 amperes, 2, take the log of that as 0.3, multiply it by 20, and the answer would be 6 dB. So when it comes to raw power input, an amplifier that draws 20 amperes versus an amplifier that draws 10 amperes, and I just gave a fairly poor example. Because in this particular case, the current is doubling, but the voltage stays the same. Therefore, I've only doubled the number of watts. That's a tough
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Cancel.
It's a good thing I caught the error I'm about to make. Because I kept the voltage constant, 20 volts, I caught your 12 volts, 10 amps versus 20 amps, that is a 2-to-1 power input difference. In that case, you would use 10 times log again. If it was a pure resistive load, and I'm changing the voltage going into the load, and if it's a pure resistive load, like a load resistor, a bleeder resistor, if I go from it's a bleeder resistor on a high voltage power supply, in my example, I have 1,000 volts going into the bleeder resistor in the first example, and I measure the voltage, 1,000 volts, into that particular resistor. And later on, I've got a different step in that power supply, and I go to 2,000 volts. And I'm only measuring the voltage, and I assume the resistor is the same resistor. It doesn't change. In that particular case, because I'm changing the voltage, and it is automatically changing the current, but I didn't measure the current. In that particular case, 2-to-1 voltage change, 2,000 divided by 1,000, at the 2-to-1 ratio, take the log of 2, 0.3, multiply by 20, that would be 6 dB. It would be a 6 decibel increase in power going into that bleeder resistor in this example. So let me show you why. I'll round off the numbers to make it simple. Assuming it is a 1,000 ohm bleeder resistor, and I first put 1,000 volts into it, by Ohm's law, it's going to draw 1 ampere. Ohm, by the way, is dissipating 1,000 watts. I then put in 2,000 volts into that resistor. By Ohm's law, it's going to draw 2 amperes. 2 amperes at 2,000 volts is 4,000 watts. So 1,000 volts, it happens to be dissipating 1,000 watts. 2,000 volts applied, it's dissipating 4,000 watts. If I calculated the wattage, 4,000 versus 1,000, 4-to-1 ratio, that's 0.6 multiplied by 10, that would be 6 decibel more dissipation, 4-to-1 power dissipation. So if it's a constant load, like your 50-ohm load of a good antenna, 50-ohm load going into your transmission line, and you're only measuring voltage, or you're only measuring current, if it is a pure resistive load, then you use the 20 log numbers, whether you measure current or voltage. If you did measure the voltage, you did measure the current, and you calculate the power, then it's 10 times log. But as you can see, they can easily fall into a trap. And the example I was starting to give in the beginning, I was keeping the voltage constant, 12 volts into an amplifier, drawing 10 amps versus 20 amps. And there, because I'm only measuring amps, you would think you would use the 20 log number. In that particular case, it is not a pure resistive load because I wasn't changing the voltage. I wasn't allowing things to move in the usual linear manner. It turns out that that second amplifier is a different load resistance than the first amplifier, the 20 ampere amplifier versus the 10 ampere amplifier. It's got to be a little...
Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
So as you can see, John, you got to be careful, and it's easy to get wrong, and a lot of people have trouble with this one, John. I haven't given you the whole story, but maybe it's enough to steer you in the right direction. KC2WGB, KQLIW, Mr. Chan.
Well, I think you'll find that valuable. Also, you can go on the web. There's a lot of tutorials on DB and this exact subject. But I guess you wanted to hear it in the spoken word, but it's probably a lot easier that way. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the second one. Okay, have a gentleman with a vertical antenna. Interesting problem, and I've been through this. Okay, what happens? He's using it for receiving, and he hears a constant ticking noise, and it's static electricity. It's affecting all three of the receivers. He wants to know, and it's sometimes it's like a heartbeat. It happens when the wind blows, and it is not a loose fitting. It is actually voltage that's appearing on the connector. So, how can he? What can he do to eliminate that? What would be your recommendations on it?
The static discharge that you hear in a case like that has two or three different possible origins. There are a few poorly designed receivers where they know that there might be voltage on the antenna. Therefore, the input to the receiver right after the connector on the front panel, on the back panel, the very next thing is a coupling capacitor into the rest of the receiver. Very bad design. But there are some receivers like that. No matter what capacitor you use for a simple capacitive coupling into a receiver, unless it is good for, let me pick a number, 50,000 volts on that capacitor, that is not the right approach. And even if it is good for 50,000 volts, for a second reason, it's not the right approach. I'll show you what happens. When the wind blows across an antenna, and if the antenna has no RF choke in the antenna itself, in other words, you put a ohm meter on the center conductor versus the shield in the shack, and if your antenna is an open circuit, like the center conductor goes to the whip, and the whip goes nowhere except up in the air, and the shield goes to the ground plane of the antenna. As the wind blows past that antenna, with static pickup on a dry day, the amount of voltage the antenna can pick up, there is no limit to it. Let me drop. If that antenna wanted to pick up a static charge of 10,000 volts, it could easily do that. And as such, under normal circumstances, that coupling capacitor you've got on the input of the receiver is going to eventually experience a voltage breakdown. And when it does, you're going to get one hell of a large clip of voltage into the rest of the receiver. And if it's a solid state front end, it could do damage. In that particular case, a bleeder resistor, and maybe the bleeder resistor is 10,000 ohms, 1,000 ohms, from center conductor to ground, inside of the receiver, for any reasonable size antenna, the total amount of current that Mother Nature can create with the dry wind blowing past your antenna up in the air usually is in the vicinity of a microampere or so. And the microampere flowing across your 1,000 ohm resistor is going to give you a millivolt of voltage there, and that's a pretty darn good RF, a DC short as far as the static pickup is concerned. But a 1,000 ohm resistor on a 50 ohm antenna is an extremely minor excess load, and it's lowering the amount of radio signal going into the antenna, into the receiver by, 0.01 dB. You never measure it. With laboratory equipment, you'd have trouble measuring it. So that's one approach. Or a real artichoke there. So antennas that have an artichoke in them solve the problem automatically. Your station master does that. You measure the ohms between semiconductor and the outer conductor of the UHF connector on a station master, and you will measure a couple of milliohms. It's a DC short circuit, even though at the operating frequency it's a 50 ohm load. Let me drop. So a station master antenna wouldn't have the problem that I'm now describing. And the simple capacitive loading, capacitive coupling into the receiver on a very simple, non-shorted ground plane antenna, the capacitor is not a good solution for about two or three reasons. One, the capacitor is going to break down. And two, even if the capacitor didn't break down, if the breakdown occurred in the connector of the antenna itself, and at the instant the antenna is producing, let me pick a number, 1,000 volts, you get 1,000 volts in that coupling capacitor, the receiver is happy for that instant, but then a breakdown occurs at 1,000 volts in the connector somewhere, in the coaxial cable, somewhere in the system, and therefore instantaneously what used to be 1,000 volts goes to 0 volts, but the coupling capacitor, you can't instantaneously change the voltage on the capacitor. That capacitor had 1,000 volts on it, on one side, and 0 volts on the receiver side, and you suddenly put the 1,000 volts down to 0 volts because of the arc over of the connector. Now that capacitor that is still charged to 1,000 volts is putting a negative 1,000 volts onto the receiver, and it can do receiver damage. So a simple coupling capacitor into a receiver is never, in my opinion, a recommended procedure. There should be at least a bleeder resistor or an RF choke somewhere in the system to make sure that static pickup doesn't occur. This is half the problem. Let me drop. Now, I've made sure that my antennas, either in the antenna itself is an RF choke or the equivalent, or there's an RF choke in the receiver. In the case of my 432 antenna, I did that. The driven element was a DC short circuit. Yet, at the 100-foot power level of my 432 antenna, when it was top antenna, and the right kind of a static condition occurred, sometimes in the wintertime, sometimes in the summertime, where on one particular occasion, I was up on the top of the tower at dusk in February when a snowstorm was coming, and I was suddenly hearing a sizzling sound, and I was watching purple glow taking place off the tips of all of the elements of the Yagi antenna. In other words, a corona discharge was taking place because of the weather condition Mother Nature was creating on that February winter day in the mild snowstorm. And therefore, I have on a number of occasions on 432 heard that sizzling sound coming out of the receiver. So even with a proper RF choke on the antenna, there could be real corona discharge on the antenna itself, and your receiver will pick that up. The solution in my case was to make sure that the mast coming out of the top of the tower extends another 5 feet or so above the 432 Yagi. Now, when Mother Nature wants to make that corona condition, the top of the mast, 5 feet above my Yagi, it does the corona is not taking place on the antenna, and essentially all of the corona noise disappears out of my receiver. How would you do that in the case of a ground plane antenna? Let me drop. If you've got a nice high location, you're on the top of the hill of your particular town, your tower sticks up above the trees, your ground plane antenna sits on the top of the tower. Metallically speaking, you are the tallest conducting object in that environment. And Mother Nature wants to create static discharge. The tip of that antenna is going to be doing that. And you're going to be hearing some loud clicking noises in your receiver. In my opinion, the only solution in that case would be to put another metallic pole alongside of your ground plane antenna that extends, let me pick a number, 5 feet higher than the antenna. At first, you're going to say to yourself, if I put a metallic pole alongside of my ground plane antenna, radio-wise, I'm creating a short circuit. Good common sense. Not true. As long as that pole that you put alongside is far enough away so that it's not giving you capacitive loading and therefore lowering the frequency of the antenna, and maybe the answer is 1 or 2 feet away horizontally, and it sticks up above the antenna another 5 feet, it takes the static discharge, not your antenna, and essentially all of the clicking sound will disappear. There was a ground plane-like antenna, a station master-like antenna, but a huge industrial version, which had a radome that was about a foot in diameter, and the antenna was 20 feet long. And it was a product of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, or I guess it was the Donna McGowan company that they purchased. It was a product of theirs that was installed on top of a mountain in Norway. And this was a great big granite mountain, and lightning would come along periodically, blast that antenna. It would blow a hole in the side of the fiberglass radome, and the metallic structures inside would get heavily damaged. And it kept happening once every year or so, and they would be sending it back for repair. I tried convincing the engineers involved that you had to put a radio tower nearby that's a little bit higher to absorb the lightning strike. Otherwise, there is no way you can protect that antenna. When you get on the top of a mountain in Norway, a lightning strike, and that lightning strike is probably 50,000 amperes for maybe 5 or 10 or 20 microseconds, that blast of energy is so many megawatts hitting that antenna, it's going to every single time blow a hole in the side of the fiberglass radome and damage the antenna inside. It kept happening once every year or so. As I said, tried convincing them, they had to put a taller metallic structure nearby. They wouldn't accept that as a solution, therefore they had to keep doing that repair every year. KC2WGB, K2LIW, go ahead, John.
Okay, Jake, very good. So you've been through it. You know what it's like. We had an issue with a bank in Manhattan that had a FM system throughout the building, and this constant annoying tick, which was coming from the static on the antenna. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It's called semiconductor tape. It's made by Scotch. It's used for making the flares and the end of high voltage devices called stress cones. Well, what we did was we just took a piece of that, put it on the antenna element, and ran it down to the lower part of the ground and taped it on there, and it completely removed it and stopped it. But you're right, if you have a capacitor on the input, I like to see like 100K or maybe 200K resistor in parallel with the capacitor. That also helps stop it, and you could put it in the ground also. But the tape did the job, and it worked very well.
And that tape is a simple bleeder resistor. The static pickup in most situations is only a few microamperes. So to bleed off a couple of microamperes with a bleeder resistor and or RF choke is fairly easy. If a direct lightning strike is going to happen on your antenna, there ain't no bleeder resistor, there ain't no coupling capacitor on planet Earth that's going to protect you. If you don't have a solid metallic object nearby to absorb that lightning strike, it's game over. Now, the good news is that even though you think that your particular radio tower is a nice shiny piece of metal sitting on top of the hill, and to your eye, it's a great big target, and you think it's going to be hit all the time. I've lived here now for 43 years. I've chosen the highest piece of land I could find that I could still afford, 300 feet above sea level. I've got 100 foot of tower on top of that, and you would think I would be struck all the time. In 43 years, I did have some damage in the house of my electronics. Not from a strike on the antenna. It came into the 110-volt line. If your eyes operate at radio frequencies, and you look at all of the 110-volt and 13-kilovolt wiring that exists in a town, where you've got these utility poles with wiring on the top of them going up and down every single street, that is a huge target. And 99.9% of the time, lightning is going to strike that target. In my case, as I said, it came in through the 110-volt line. So, radio-wise, I have no evidence, per se, that my tower, which I think is the tallest metallic structure in this town, in 43 years, I think it has never been struck. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
And people would find that hard to believe. And, yeah, I believe if it's grounded properly and it's discharging, probably wouldn't even be seen by the lightning. But those Edison wires would give black all the time. All right, Dick, now I have a question, nothing to do with radio, a little bit of science question from a 12-year-old. Let me let it drop. This young man listens to the TechNet sometimes. His brother is 17 years old, and he listens all the time. So he thought he'd submit a question, and I thought this was cute. He's interested to know, why is it high tide is caused by a full moon? Because when it's half moon or a quarter moon, the moon is still there. So the gravity is still there. So he wants to know what's going on there. Could you help him out? C2WDB, back to you, Dick.
Without a doubt, 99% of what you and I call tides is caused by the moon. Maybe it's 97%, but a high percentage is caused by the moon. And you would think the moon is an object going around the Earth. Good, common sense, simple diagram in the book. Not quite true. The moon and the Earth are a binary system. The two of them are going around a common mass center. It's a little bit equivalent to you take your wooden yardstick, 36 inches long, you suspend it at the 18-inch position, and you put a weight on the left side, you put a weight on the right side, equal size weight. You build a kind of a seesaw. You've got a balance system, and you could, if you want to, rotate that yardstick in a circle parallel to the Earth. In other words, you've now created a pivot at the 18-inch position on your yardstick, and the two of them are rotating around that point. However, if I put a very heavy weight on the left side and a fairly light weight on the right side, and I find the balance position, instead of it being at the 18-inch point, maybe it's at the 8-inch point. So 8 inches from one end is where this unbalanced seesaw balances. That's the mass center of the system. And I could, if I want to, now either swing it up and down as a seesaw, or I could rotate it around that pivot. Rotate the yardstick so that it moves in a manner that stays parallel to the Earth, and it would be thoroughly balanced. I've got a heavy weight on the left side, a light weight on the right side, a pivot at the 8-inch point of the 36-inch yardstick, and I'm rotating around that 8-inch point on the yardstick, and I could rotate that thing as fast as I want, and it would stay balanced. That, believe it or not, is the way the Earth works. The Earth is the heavy weight on the left side of the yardstick. The yardstick is not quite there.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The moon is the light thing on the right-hand side of the yardstick, and the two of them are rotating around a mass center. That mass center is located at the equator of the Earth, roughly 1,000 miles below the surface. The Earth has a 4,000-mile radius, 8,000-mile diameter, 4,000-mile radius, so 3,000 miles from the center of the Earth, 1,000 miles below the surface of the Earth, at the equator, that is the mass center of the Earth-Moon system. Earth and Moon are both rotating around that mass center. If you made an accurate map of the Earth going around the Sun in 1 year, you think it's a near circle. It's not. It is a wiggly diagram. The diagram has, because the moon goes around the Earth roughly 12 times per year, the what looks like a circle has got 12 individual wiggles to it as it goes around the Sun. That's what the Earth is really doing. So the Earth is moving in this wiggly pattern because it really is a binary system of Earth and Moon. Now let's see what's happening. That binary system, because of the gravity attraction of the moon, the water on the Earth bulges out in the direction toward the moon. That's what we understand. But because the Earth is whipping around that mass center, the Earth is really wiggling, you're getting a simultaneous high tide on the far side of the Earth. There really are two high tides at every instant of time on the Earth. One of those high tides is toward the moon, one of those high tides is away from the moon, because the Earth is really rotating around that particular mass center point. Okay. If you now did an interesting experiment that I sometimes hit people with this thought experiment. Let me drop this. Assume now that the the Beck Nadel Company, a very respected firm, John Beck and Dick Nadel, KC2WGB and KQLAW accordingly. The Beck Nadel Company invented this beautiful gravity testing machine. And so the chief engineer, John, one day, sets up the machine in his backyard at high noon. He aims the machine at the sun, and he measures the amount of solar gravity that comes into his backyard. At the full moon, at midnight, the next night, he aims the machine toward the moon, and he measures the amount of lunar gravity in the backyard. So in his backyard, he measures, first measures the amount of lunar gravity